Welcome to Stout Audio, produced at Spruce Knob Studios in Middletown Springs, Vermont. Stout brings you stories and ideas about the things you've seen a thousand times but never really looked at. Welcome to the show. Here's your host, Herb Childress. I wrote part of this story 13 years ago, and I thought it was done. But then a couple of years back, I was having a conversation with a local fellow as we were in the woods cutting firewood, talking about the barbed wire left from generations before. And that conversation, and the implications of what barbed wire meant for him, led to a new second half of this story. So here's another from the series, A Field Guide to Men of the 1970s. It's set in Muskegon, Michigan in 1975, and it's called My Cupcake Pal. Slush everywhere. If there's a hell, it'll look like March in Michigan. The temperature, back and forth between 20 and 40. The gray sky, back and forth between snow and rain. Isn't winter, isn't spring, isn't much of anything. The roads and parking lots banked by plowed dunes of dirty snow, rain washed down to their essential nature of iced mud. The brief pleasure of a ham sandwich and cherry pie and escape from the office muted by the knowledge that I'd be out in that crap again after lunch. I drove back, parked in my marked spot close to the building, two spaces away from the door and next to my boss's Continental, away from the fleet of parking for the shop floor. I hadn't even gotten my coat off, though, before my office girl, Rachel, gave me a big envelope. Happy 15th, she said. Drug test day. Oh, crap, I forgot all about that. Now, don't worry, we've been getting a lot of applications since Warner No. 3 closed. You won't have any trouble with replacements. I suppose I just hate doing it. Firing people was nasty business at best, and firing these guys was a step beyond that. Big, dumb, and angry. Made them good mill workers, I suppose, but it also led to a lot of shouting at termination, and most of them were half a foot taller and half a hundred bigger than me. Security always got double assigned to the human resources suite around this time of the month. The envelope was about the usual thickness, no surprising numbers this month. December and January were the worst. 2 months of holidays and football and their year-end bonus. Positive coke tests way up. Random drunk tests on the morning line pulling in dozens on a bad Friday. By March, everybody was too broke and too depressed to party much, and the positives fell back to normal. We had about 2,400 men in the shop, half on first shift, the other half spread across second and third. We pulled about 150 a month into the John for a urine sample, and usually a dozen or so lab tests came back positive. I'd have my talk with three or four a day for the next week, catching the second shift guys when they came in at 3:30, the first shift when they left at 5, and the third shift when they went home at 7 in the morning. A dozen a month out of 2,400, half of 1%. Their absence would be noticed by the rest of the herd on the first day, forgotten by the second, replaced by the third. Every time I walked through the floor, I was reminded of Uncle Bob's dairy farm down by Berrien Springs. 300 milkers, 20,000 pounds of milk a day. Uncle Bob got rid of a few of his herd every month, too, off to Campbell's for beef noodle soup. I opened the envelope, the gold ISM letterhead seal at the top. Industrial Safety Monitoring, protecting your investment. We paid ISM $6 for each test, about $900 a month. Three journeyman salaries, more or less. And even that didn't catch all of them, not by a long shot. Most of it was coke, but we'd started to see some angel dust a few months ago. One guy was stoned out of his gourd and went after two other guys on the line with a strike-off bar. One broke an arm, a collarbone, and a concussion before five security guys took him down. The union steward tried to cover for him, said he'd gotten hooked on PCP from his stress from Vietnam, but the steward's own members went against him. They didn't want to be on the line with a guy who'd start swinging a 12-pound steel bar with no warning. The cover letter showed the February tallies. 148 tests, 139 clear. Three pages of tiny type after that, the names of all the guys with clean tests. One page with the names of those who'd failed, and then a page apiece for the dirty tests with the details of their lab work. I put the clean pages back in the envelope. Rachel would note the test date and results in each of their files. They'd still have jobs. Not like the 800 guys laid off last month from Warner Coil and Wires Plant Number 3. And not like the 9 guys in this pile. I read down the summary sheet of the fails. Lots of cocaine, 1 phenobarbital, a PCP, a benzodiazepine. A couple of guys with doubles. I never thought that a management degree from Michigan State would lead to so much experience with pharmacology. But I never thought it'd lead me back here either. One of the names, Thomas Poddig, seemed familiar, but I couldn't place him. The others, just diseased cattle to be culled. I put it all back into the envelope and went into the file hall. The 12 office girls were there, stationed 3 rows across and 4 deep, most of them centered around one of the desks and chatting before lunch gave way inexorably to the afternoon. I handed the envelope to Rachel. Only 9 this month. I'll get their files in a minute, she said, and then leaned toward me and spoke quietly. Good thing you don't drug test these girls. You'd lose half of them. My little tattletale. A nice lunch at Black Angus every few weeks, and she'd sell out her co-workers and her mom besides. Every HR office needs its spy network. About 10 minutes later, she came into my office with a stack of file folders, 1 for each of the doomed. Here they are. She seemed pleased to be delivering them to their demise, so I figured I'd play her out a couple of feet. Close the door, would you? She closed it, sat in my visitor chair. Tell me what you meant about the other girls in the pool, I said. Her tight smile said, I really shouldn't, but her wide eyes said, oh, I can't wait. No names, I said, just in general. And that was all the push she needed. Well, one of the girls, she goes off to Kalamazoo to see her boyfriend every weekend, and she always comes back and talks about all the nightclubs they went to. They even go to hear music in Chicago sometimes. So she was talking about this pill they have in the clubs that just makes you want to dance for hours and hours. She called it Adam. She said it's totally safe and it's not even illegal. And, you know, the younger girls, they don't have any fun places to go here, so it sounded really exciting. I think 4 or 5 of the girls use it now, on weekends and stuff. She was more animated than I'd seen her in the 3 years we'd worked together. I couldn't tell if she was more excited by squealing on her friends or by having the second-hand experience of describing city life and dancing and boys. I looked at Rachel's face and then at her legs tightly together between her mid-length dress and wondered myself about city life and dancing and girls. This place bred loneliness. It set its full load of despair in a slushy dune right behind your breastbone, and every so often would give it a twist, just so you didn't forget. I came back home because loneliness and home were the same, because loneliness was so oddly comfortable. I could tell that Rachel knew that despair, too. I could hear her loneliness, unspoken, telepathic. A naive romantic would tell me to ask Rachel out on a date, that we should get together to break out of our loneliness. But my parents had taught me that putting 2 lonely people together just amplifies the silences, shoves everyone further into isolation, secrets gaining unbearable weight through every hour that passed. Silence was the language I had mastered, my native tongue. Well, I said, I guess I'm not too worried about it so far. It's not like these guys on the floor that can get people killed if they forget to latch a blast door. But if you think it's getting out of hand, let me know. And thanks for keeping me filled in. She smiled, happy to be among the clean and virtuous, and walked out. I picked up the file she'd left on the desk, leafed through for Poddig, Thomas. He'd been at the factory for 4 years, lived on Ponta Luna Road in Fruitport, out by the high school. Date of birth, oh shit, that's why I knew him, Tommy Poddig from 5th grade. Tommy had singled me out from the other kids at recess on the first day of fall, finding me standing by myself and asking me if I wanted to ride the teeter-totter, pushing each other faster and faster until he rolled himself off in a backward somersault when he got to the bottom of his side and I fell straight down 6 feet and cried in a heap, ankle-twisted and butt-sore while he laughed. He made me his personal project that whole year, tripping me in soccer, pushing me into the backstop when we played kickball, putting handfuls of wet aquarium gravel into my lunch sack. The goldfish, too, once. He had come to the school at the beginning of fifth grade and stayed through just that 1 year, proving himself to be the stupidest kid in every subject except gym, where he was a master at every sport and skill. He and I were polar opposites, and we both knew it, and we both resented it, but he had the physical and amoral ability to do something about it. Mrs. Reiser couldn't change him. The principal, Mrs. Winters, couldn't change him. He failed tests, he got sent to detention, he got held inside at lunch and kept after school, he sassed back the art teacher, none of it mattered. His date of birth was the key to my memories. Every time one of the kids in class had a birthday, Mrs. Reiser would ask one of the other parents to make a snack for a celebration in class. My birthday was coming April 8th, and I'd been looking forward to that one little 15-minute celebration where the other kids would have to be nice to me and not just tolerate me because I could get them a better grade when I got picked to be on their math team or their spelling team. I woke up on April 8th, a Thursday, and put on my coolest clothes, my new rain jacket, and walked to school just burning to see what the snack would be. The better the snack, the more borrowed happiness you got from the other kids. They'd be grateful for their cookie or whatever, and a little of that gratitude leaked out onto the birthday child. About 11 o'clock, Mrs. Reiser went to her locker and brought out a tray of cupcakes. Cupcakes. A total victory. Chocolate cupcakes with chocolate frosting. I almost fainted from pure pleasure. And then Mrs. Reiser said, "We have two birthdays today. It's Philip Stone's birthday and Tommy Pottig's birthday. Sing happy birthday, everybody." I stood in disbelief and shame about six desks away from where Tommy stood while the rest of the kids all sang us happy birthday. The third line broke and metered with the kids jamming two names into the line, "Happy birthday, Philip and Tommy," and a third of the kids singing instead, "Happy birthday, Tommy and Philip," to add to the discord. No room for the word dear in that shambles. Watching all the other kids rush to the desk to get their cupcake, Tommy and I going last, as was the tradition. Two left. Tommy picked them both up, handed me one, and just as I got my hand out, let it drop to the floor. Mrs. Reiser already had her back turned to take the plate to the sink. Didn't see it. Tommy took a big bite out of his and walked back to his desk. My cupcake on the floor, of course, frosting down, stuck to the floor, contrasted with the floor itself, faintly white from the salt tracked in on hundreds of boots. I picked it up, saw bits of sand on the flattened icing. Mrs. Reiser came back at that moment. "Oh, Philip, did you drop yours?" She sighed. "You're so uncoordinated. Here, let me get you a wet paper towel so you can clean the spot you made on the floor." The other kids all looking down, hunched over their desks, devouring their feed. I wiped the floor and went back to my seat, got my ruler out of the desk, and scraped off the flattened side of the frosting. My cupcake was gritty, tasted faintly of salt. And now here, 16 years later, Tommy and I back together, come full circle. Our shared birthday only 3 weeks away. On this next birthday, I'd have a job, and he wouldn't. I looked at his job title, Production Support Worker 2, basically a gopher, taking parts and tools from one shop location to another. Not an indispensable member of the shift. We could take him off the floor anytime. And no time like the present. I picked up my phone, called security, asked them to bring Tommy Pottig into my office. About 20 minutes later, a giant man came in through the door, a field of navy blue in his shop coveralls, well over 6 feet, broad shoulders, shaved the beard, and he could have played outfield for the Tigers. I could see his earplugs and his nose filters in his free hand as he closed the door behind him. Two security guys stayed in the hallway outside. "They told me you wanted to see me." "Thomas Pottig, right?" "Tommy, yeah." "You were chosen at random in February for a year analysis. We have the results back, and it looks like you failed that test. It came back positive for cocaine plus an unspecified amphetamine." He stood, immobile, expression unchanging. "You know that we give a second chance for alcohol and marijuana violations, but a positive test for harder drugs is an automatic termination." Again, I couldn't read his face at all, but he said, "So I'm done is what you're saying." "Yes, Tommy, your employment is terminated, effective immediately." I expected a dozen things. I expected him to deny the results. I expected him to yell about the injustice, about hard workers never getting a break. I half expected him to charge me. I didn't expect this. "Okay," he said, and turned to leave. "Tommy, wait," I said, or rather a voice that sounded like mine. "Maybe there's something we can... I mean... I didn't understand why I was doing this, didn't know what had overtaken me. And just as quickly, I did. I wanted him to beg. I wanted him to grovel, to whimper, to plead for a second chance, to admit to being a failure and a loser and a half-ass. I wanted him to tell me that I had something he needed, wanted just one time to have the power in our relationship. I wanted to grant him forgiveness for this sin so that maybe later he'd recognize the others and beg my mercy for those too. He stopped, hand on the doorknob, and looked back at me. "Don't do me no favors," he said, and walked out, closing the door quietly behind him. The two security guys fell in behind him as they walked off to the locker room. And I was right back to Mrs. Reiser's classroom, watching Tommy walked out of class any one of 50 times by the assistant principal. His temporary punishment by others meant nothing to me. I knew he'd be back with nothing changed. I wanted him to acknowledge that he had been mean to me and to be sorry for it and not to have some bullshit black mark added to a folder of other black marks. I just sat for a few minutes, my eyes closed. Then I squared up Tommy's papers, put them back in their folder, and walked them over to Rachel. "Termination papers for Thomas Pottig," I said. She was in mid-calculation, her right hand flashing over the 10 key as she scrolled down with her left over a list of numbers, and just nodded. I'd barely gotten behind my desk when I heard my office door open. "Mr. Stone, can I talk to you for a minute?" It was Lori, one of the other girls from the pool. She came in, closed the door, sat. "Did you just fire Tommy Pottig?" "Yes, I did. Positive drug test, that's the sequence." She looked at me straight. "Tommy's my boyfriend." Stopped with that. No further qualifiers. "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Lori." And I was sorry. Sorry that her boyfriend was out of work, and doubly sorry that her boyfriend was Tommy. I remembered another guy we fired a couple of months ago who'd gone to jail later that night for beating up his wife, and I said, "Are you going to be okay? Is he going to take it out on you or someone else around you?" Her eyes never wavered. "He's a good man. We were getting ourselves ahead a little, thinking about having a baby." Her voice halted a bit, but her eyes did not. "Do you have to fire him? Can't you give us another chance?" "Lori, you know the rules. If it was pot, I could give him a week's suspension, but cocaine is an automatic out." "Yeah, I know the rules, but I know Tommy. He parties hard, but he works hard too. You wouldn't be in that chair if he wasn't out there on that floor, burning his hands, his back sore for hours every night. Please, Mr. Stone, I'm begging you. We need his job. We do." My hesitation must have seemed like an opening because she leaned forward in her chair. "Listen, why don't you come have a drink with us tonight? We can talk about it and see if there's anything we can do." And that's how I found myself driving into the parking lot at Henry's, a roadhouse out near the state park. It was a warmer, drizzly night, and there must have been 15 motorcycles in the gravel lot along with another 10 or 12 cars, chrome headlights and handlebars sparkling through the million raindrops. I went in through the vestibule entry and into a gust of voices and laughter and music. Four or five guys around a pool table, Steppenwolf blaring from the jukebox, men and a fair number of women three deep around the bar. Then a voice above the crowd, "Hey, there's the guy that let me loose today," followed by a cheer from the masses. 50 of them, all his buddies, and one of me. Tommy and Lori worked themselves out of the crowd and came over. He shook my hand, towering over me, and said, "What are you drinking?" 7 and 7. I felt like I was making the request for my last meal. "Get us a tray of 7s, babe," he said to Lori, and put his arm around my shoulder. I winced at the contact, expecting a beating. "Me and Mr. Stone got to have a conference over here." He walked us away from the crowd to a corner table where the jukebox didn't quite reach. "So, Lori says you're thinking about not firing me after all, huh?" "Well, she asked me to come talk to you about it anyway. She says you guys are pretty tight and this'll set you back." He laughed. "You think? Got a factory closing every year. It ain't going to be easy to just walk through another shop door after this. Gonna be a fucking ghost town in 10 years. Lori appeared at that moment with a tray and 3 glasses. Tommy passed them around, raised his glass. Here's to ghosts, man. Tommy, do you remember me from when we were kids? He looked at me over his drink, head cocked a little. No, can't say I do. 5th grade, Thompson Elementary, Mrs. Reiser's classroom. He held his examination for a few more seconds. Nope, not ringing a bell. I took a drink and a deep breath to settle myself. Well, I remember you. I remember you beating me up all year, more days than not. I remember being sick to my stomach every morning before I went to school, knowing that you were waiting for me. I remember, wait a minute, Lori said, you fired him because he beat you up in 5th grade? That's just fucked up. No, I fired him because he peed in a cup and came back more cocaine than water. I paused for a second. I'm giving him a second chance because he beat me up in 5th grade. Tommy laughed loud. Now that's fucked up. I beat up a lot of kids when I was little. I need to find out where they work now. Maybe I can get a job from one of them. I guess I need to know why, I said quietly. I need to know what it was about me that made you hate me so much. Nothing, probably. He leaned back in his chair, took a deep swallow of his drink. Clearly not his first. Listen, I wasn't going to get nowhere in class. I knew that by 1st grade. Whatever I was going to get in the world, I was going to get because I took it and fought to keep it. My dad and my brothers taught me that, and all them lady teachers taught me that I didn't have nothing else. He looked straight at me. You and all them other little kids were like the scrimmage team, so I could practice taking things before I got to tougher people later on. Did it help? He finished the rest of his drink in one lift. You tell me. He pulled out his wallet, unfolded a slip of paper worn thin, dozens of tiny holes punched in it. He slid it across to me. I picked it up. His draft card. Issued in 1968. We'd have been 19. What are all the holes? He took the card back, took the red drink stirrer out of the ice in his glass, put it through the hole in the upper left corner. Cam Duck, May 68. Caught this one crawling under the barbed wire around our camp. My first one. He moved the stirrer to the next hole. Next night, this one was trying to put a mine in our landing field. He sat the card down. Some others. You can figure it out. Each hole a ghost. So I guess I should say thanks, he said. I learned to watch. Learned how to catch other kids by surprise, to not be scared of a fight. I learned to walk straight into a mess and not hide. And after 3 years of not running from the VC and the NBA, I could walk straight toward a 2,500-degree blast furnace. I could knock a man down before a slop trolley took off his head. I ain't afraid of nothing now. He stopped. Maybe you should say thanks, too. You need guys like me around, even if you don't like us. He shook his empty glass. Drinks on you this round. The next morning, I got to the shop, head pounding, and called Rachel into my office. Rachel, I'm going to need your help. And you can't ever tell anybody about this. If you decide you don't want to do this, just tell me, and I'll quit my job. Her eyes were wide, but shone with excitement. What is it? I want you to take Thomas Pottig's name off the positive drug test list. I want you to take his lab report and shred it. And I want him to come back to work tomorrow. Really? Can you do that? Lori was so worried about him yesterday. I know. We had a talk last night after work, all three of us. And I think he's going to be okay. But I can only do it if you help. She paused, clearly not deciding whether, but deciding how. After a few seconds, she said, okay, sure. Win one for the little guy, right? He's not so little, I laughed, and she laughed along with me. As she stood to leave, I said, hey, Rachel, I was wondering, you want to go see a movie with me tonight? Another pause, and then a smile. Yeah, that'd be fun. That was My Cupcake Pal, another story from the series A Field Guide to Men of the 1970s. Thanks for being with us, and we'll look forward to seeing you again at another episode of Stout Audio.